From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. In our first half hour today, we learn about a new project by the Office of the State Archaeologist that involves flying airborne lasers. The project uses what is called light detection and ranging technology, or LIDAR, to do virtual surveys of hundreds of Native American burial mounds, some of which were found in the state as far back as the 1890s. Then in our second half hour, Professor of Natural Philosophy, Physics, and Astronomy, Marcelo Gleiser, on his new book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. In it, he puts forth a radical new vision for life in the universe. We get started right after this news. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us over this noon hour on a beautiful day across the state. Later in the hour, we turn our gaze skyward to ponder the origins and workings of the universe with astronomist and physicist Marcelo Gleiser, author of the new book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. But first, we climb aboard an aircraft with new technology to gaze down at the Earth in the hopes of making new discoveries about the prehistoric people who lived on the landscape we call Iowa. It's a new project by the Office of the State Archaeologist that involves flying airborne lasers. It uses what is called light detection and ranging technology, or LIDAR for short. It does a virtual survey of hundreds of Native American burial mounds, some of which were found in the state as far back as the 1890s. Joining me in the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Iowa City to tell us more about it, two guests from the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa, Joe Artz, he is director of the Geospatial Program, and Melanie Riley, Geographical Information Science Specialist. Joe and Melanie, welcome to you both.
Hey, Ben.
Thank you.
First, Joe, if you could remind us what these prehistoric mounds are all about.
About 2,500 years ago, Native Americans began burying their dead in earthen mounds that they would build specifically for that purpose. The first ones were conical, dome-shaped mounds. They can range anywhere from 30, 40, 50 centimeters, a couple of feet, up to tens of feet high. There are hundreds of these mounds across Iowa and all across the Midwest and in the eastern North America. That mound building continued in some places, or the burial in mounds continued in some places up until contact times.
Mm-hmm. And the best known of these mounds, would we say, the effigy mounds up near Harper's Ferry in northeast Iowa?
Exactly. There are other great mound groups at Pikes Peak State Park. That's another great place to go see mounds in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. What are the greatest unanswered questions about these mounds for you as an archaeologist?
The most interesting questions, I think, at this point are what they mean, what they can tell us about what people believed at the time. We don't excavate mounds anymore out of respect for the dead. They're cemeteries. But we do look at the amount of distance you can see from, say, a mound, how mounds are intervisible between one another across the landscape, whether there are astronomical arrangements of the mounds, how people were using them. In some cases, we think to mark their territories or their clan boundaries.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so now that we have an idea of what these mounds are about, a reminder of that, let's turn to this technology, light detection and ranging technology that you're using. Melanie Riley, how does LIDAR work? There's a plane with some lasers.
Yes, there's a plane mounted with a laser sensor and quite a bit of other gadgetry to get precise positioning of the laser. And this laser has been tweaked down so it doesn't cause blindness in people and animals as it shoots down to the earth. The beam is in a near-infrared light range, so we as humans cannot actually see the laser, but it acts like any other light.
So when we see it, one of these planes, and have they been up? They've been surveying the state already, right?
Yes. It's almost completed. There's just a handful of counties left that they're flying this spring.
So had we seen one, it would have been just a normal sort of Piper Cub type of plane or a little bit larger?
Yeah, some smaller aircraft, light aircraft. And you really wouldn't know what they were doing if you looked at it. The flight is nearly completed. They started as far back as 2006 in the data collection.
Okay, so this is similar to mapping like the ocean floor. So they're doing it in a methodical, it's being done in a methodical way in stripes, I can imagine, so that we completely map the geography with how much more detail using LIDAR?
Well, what we have available right before LIDAR was a 10-meter resolution elevation data, meaning each square pixel on your screen would represent 10 meters of horizontal space or 100 square meters per pixel. Now we have 1-meter resolution, which means you could fit 100 of those little 1-meter squares into what we had before. So it's that much sharper. The data, the elevation data we had before had accuracy of plus or minus 5 feet. Now we're talking about an elevation accuracy of 6 to 7 inches.
6 to 7 inches. So we get much more precise with LIDAR. So let's now, in reference to the mounds, the burial mounds, 2,500 did you say, Joe? Approximately 2,500 in Iowa, and I think there's also some of the work that your office is doing in southern Minnesota, in Minnesota. What difference does that make in detecting and describing these mounds?
Well, before a lot of our mounds that we know about were from really old surveys from the late 1800s up through the 1930s, and the location information can be kind of scanty. And so in Iowa, actually 37% of the mound sites we know about, we don't have precise locations of. And we don't have funding to send someone out there to trudge through the woods all day long trying to relocate these.
So things. They were mapped as long ago as the 1890s. Mm-hmm. They're recorded in some document, but people haven't been out to see them since?
In some cases, that's true. In other places, we have verified them and enough to know that the one fellow in particular, T.H. Lewis, back in the 1880s, 1890s, was doing an excellent job. He was an excellent surveyor, and the maps that he made of mound groups are still valuable to this day. One of the things that we're doing in our Minnesota project is overlaying his maps on top of the LIDAR maps as a guide to where we should be looking to find the maps on LIDAR.
Uh-huh. So aside from location, so we want to precisely locate these, make sure we know where all they are, where they all are, and perhaps discover new ones that yet unknown?
Yes. That's been the case so far that occasionally I'll come across one that even the surveys from the 1800s or the 1930s, they might have seen one, but the vegetation was so thick that they didn't see another one about 50 yards away.
Mm-hmm. How does a man-made, a human-made mound made by prehistoric people differ? How is it recognizable when compared to just a mound of earth that was formed naturally?
It's symmetrical. I think that's the main thing that that stands out about them is that they're very round, a lot rounder than you would expect if it was a hump of soil created when a tree fell over. If it's a conical mound, the center is right exactly in the middle of the mound. It's their symmetry that really stands out. Other mounds are linear in shape. They'll be long, sort of tube-like.
So they're obviously something not from nature.
Yes.
That's how you detect it, the shapes that they are. Now, what difference does it make the season in which these surveys, these overflights were made? Because you were talking about, early surveyors having problems with vegetation and so forth. Wouldn't that cause, if you had a heavy growth of forest or vegetation, wouldn't that also cause problems for lasers, or can they see through all this stuff?
They can't really see through it. one of the important things of flying LIDAR to get good bare earth digital elevation models is to make sure you fly leaf off, where there's no leaves or buds on the deciduous trees here in Iowa. And
so the winter months.
Preferably after the snow melts, because it will take the elevation of the snow. So then you have the elevation as it is with the snow piled on top mm-hmm. of the landscape. So preferably right after the snow melts, when all the understory vegetation is packed down still and the leaves are off the trees, so the laser light filters through just like sunlight and hits the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The notion is that as the laser is fired from the airplane, it bounces back to the airplane, and the airplane measures the distance that it's traveled.
Down to a plus or minus 5 inches.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because so many of these beams can be fired in a short period of time. So they're collecting literally millions of these points as they fly. Mm-hmm. Some of the points will hit tree branches or building tops and come back, but they can tell from the deepest penetration that they're making, that the light beams are making, where the bare earth is.
Mm-hmm.
And so many times what we're looking for and what a lot of people are looking for in the LIDAR is that bare earth signal. Others, like foresters, are interested in what the tree canopy looks like.
So they can get that from a different
right.
Look at the LIDAR results.
And your county tax people are interested in how big your building is, how big your house is.
Oh, no. Lots of uses for LIDAR. Where,
many.
If we were to look at a map of the Midwest, Iowa, and where would you be active doing this? Where would you, in terms of these burial mounds? You're not only in Iowa, but also in southern Minnesota. So are we talking northeast Iowa? Where would the patches be that you're most interested in?
The farthest west mounds that I'm aware of are on the Missouri River in western North Dakota. Mounds are ubiquitous throughout the eastern United States. They're most often along major rivers on high bluffs, but that's not necessarily always the case. There are thousands of these mounds still preserved.
Okay, we have to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk more about virtual surveys, new virtual surveys created by airborne lasers to investigate burial mounds of prehistoric peoples in Iowa and the rest of the Midwest. Joe Arzt is with us. He is the director of the geospatial program at the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa. Also at that office, Melanie Riley, geographical information scientist. Science specialist. If you have questions or comments, 1-866-780-9100. Fascinating topic here. 1-866-780-9100, or email us, theexchange@iowapublicradio.org. When I come back, we'll talk about the impact this type of archaeology, which is unique, may have on archaeologists across the nation. That's when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, Professor of Natural Philosophy, Physics, and Astronomy Marcelo Gleiser on his new book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. In it, Gleiser puts forth a radical new vision for life in the universe. Currently, though, we're looking, we're finding out about new virtual surveys created by airborne lasers, LIDAR technology being put to use for archaeology. Joe Arzt, director of the Geospatial Program, the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa, along with geographical information science specialist Melanie Riley. And during the break, you wanted to point out that LIDAR is not specifically for archaeology. In fact, when it was originally used, this is just a tangential sort of application that it's found. How many other applications are there for LIDAR?
Oh, there are hundreds. The statewide LIDAR project that's being flown that Melanie was referring to earlier is being headed up by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, and the Department of other agencies have kicked into that. But Johnson County is one of the counties that have obtained their own LIDAR information. One of the applications that that it can be used for. Obviously, the 6-inch elevation would be great for doing floodplain mapping.
Mm-hmm.
Melanie can talk about some of the other applications that it's being used for.
Another aspect is any civil engineering projects, your road projects, bridges, anything that involves earth removal. They can calculate the volume of the earth that they need to remove for their projects, and it actually makes pricing contracts better. It saves in time in planning. You have better planning of these large projects. And agriculture has there's huge implications for agriculture, because you can get better erosion control structure design because you have a better look at the topography. It improves your soils mapping because you can see where the different soils are delimited better, and which helps out with precision farming. And there's other water quality for watershed modeling, studying runoff, and Joe mentioned earlier forest characterization in biology.
How unique is this use for back to archaeology, this use of LIDAR for archaeology in the United States that you're going about right here?
It has, it's at the very beginnings in lots of ways in its evolution. It hasn't been used a lot by archaeologists yet, partially because the data are not have not been available. Iowa, for example, was the second state to start acquiring it across the entire state. The one thing about LIDAR is that the information is publicly available.
So we can go to anybody can go to a website and view the data?
Yeah, there is a website that the GIS community, the geographic information community in the state, maintain that showing the 1 meter resolution LIDAR. It's a very detailed kind of hillshade map.
How do people find that website?
It's the easiest way to find it is to Google OrthoServer, OrthoServer, and also include Iowa State or just IA State. That'll get you to this map server.
What do you think the impact will be, since it's just in the beginnings here, we're getting early data here in Iowa, what will be the impact on archaeology across the country from this pioneering effort using LIDAR?
One immediate application that it's going to have is our ability to preserve burial mounds. Right now, it's the only way to find burial mounds is to go out into the field and look for them. Now we'll be able to, using one of the tools perhaps that Melanie has developed, we'll be able to scan large tracts of land for mounds. Once we know where they are, we can put them on the radar screen for local preservation. People interested in preservation can keep an eye on them, and the state can keep an eye on them.
Let's go to Randy in Poweshiek County. Thanks for calling the Exchange. Hi, Randy.
Hi. Repeat that website, would you, so I can get it wrote down?
You betcha. The way I usually go to it, because I can never keep my bookmarks organized, is I Google OrthoServer, OrthoServer, and then I add to my search string IA State. It's housed at the Iowa State University. So OrthoServer, IA State.
Randy, we are running out of time. You have a quick question?
Years ago up in southern Benton County, mushroom hunting, a friend of mine said that he knew where there were some burial mounds up there. Will this information you just give me on the Google thing pull that up for me? Or I'd like to see some of the stuff today where people can't find it, because, you know, people get greedy and they want to mess with stuff.
That's exactly. We have a website that shows the number of sites recorded per square mile in Iowa. And you can get to that by the web link is www.uiowa.edu/OSA.
It sounds like LIDAR could also be used at what Randy's referring to when people are looting these burial sites. That could be discovered.
Actually, I have found several cases where I can see the potholes in the mounds, but what we call potholes is where looters have dug tremendous holes or trenches in the middle of the mounds trying to find relics.
Interesting. Thank you, Randy, for that call from Poweshiek County. Very quickly, before we have to go, how is this whole project financed?
Our work in Minnesota is through the Minnesota Historical Society. It's a pilot project. We're looking in four mounds. We're looking at the mounds in two counties there. So that's coming from the Minnesota Historical Society. The work in LIDAR in Iowa is being funded by a consortium of agencies that in 2005 put together $4.5 million. And that comes down to costing about 75 cents a square mile. It's one of those technologies where you get a lot of bang for your buck.
Now, Melanie, you recently completed your master's in geographic information science with an emphasis on remote sensing technology. Your thesis focused on the efficacy of LIDAR for detecting prehistoric burial mounds in the state and developing a prototype tool to automate the detection of burial mounds. What's the importance of automating the detection of burial mounds?
In remote sensing, when you're looking at large areas over a period of time, it often causes fatigue in the interpreter. And sometimes it's not very easy to take. The scale is so different than what we're used to. It sometimes is hard to tell if that could be a mound or something else without visualizing it in 3D, and that also takes a long time to do. So I developed a prototype model or a prototype tool which scans across the landscape, taking in consideration the actual elevation values in each cell, and figuring based on relief and aspect and slope and what a typical mound fits in that, it'll mark it whether it thinks it's a mound or not. And that cuts down on a lot of time.
So we have just a few seconds left. Tell me, Joe, the next milestone on this LIDAR project here in Iowa. What will we look forward to? You said it's almost completed in the state.
The LIDAR has been flown for the entire state. In terms of archaeology, we have in mind and have sent out a couple of grant proposals to apply and further develop Melanie's model to go, you know, finding mounds in Iowa.
Well, we should continue good luck with this fascinating research that we have. We have probably many of us seen these airplanes, and now we know what some of them are for, besides just flying back and forth over the state. Thank you very much, Joe Arts and Melanie Riley of the Office of the State Archaeologist at the University of Iowa. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, we turn our gaze skyward to ponder the origins and workings of the universe. Professor of Natural Philosophy, Physics, and Astronomy Marcelo Gleiser will be talking about his new book, A Tear at the Edge of Creation. In it, Gleiser puts forth a radical new vision for life in the universe. Cosmology when we come back. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. For millennia, shamans and philosophers, believers and non-believers, artists and scientists have tried to make sense of our existence by suggesting that everything is connected, that a mysterious oneness binds us to everything. People go to temples, churches, mosques, and synagogues to pray to their divine incarnation of oneness. My next guest says that following a surprisingly similar notion, scientists have long asserted that under nature's apparent complexity, there is a simpler underlying reality. In its modern incarnation, this theory of everything would unite the physical laws governing very large bodies, such as Einstein's theory of relativity, and those governing tiny ones, such as quantum mechanics, into a single framework. However, Marcelo Gleiser argues in his latest book that the universe is not elegant. It is, in fact, gloriously messy. Marcelo Gleiser is the Appleton Professor of Natural Philosophy and Professor of Physics and Astronomy at Dartmouth College, where he runs an active cosmology group. Marcelo Gleiser is the author of The Dancing Universe and The Prophet and the Astronomer. He's a founding member and writer for the newly launched 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog at NPR. His latest book is called A Tear at the Edge of Creation, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe, published by Free Press. And we welcome Marcelo Gleiser joining us by phone from Vermont, I believe.
Almost Vermont, on the border of Vermont, New Hampshire still.
Okay, very good. First, I'd like to have you outline the conventional scientific thinking, the code that you argue against in this book, the so-called theory of everything.
Right. So since the beginning of philosophy, way before science, we're talking 650 years before Christ, people have started to look at the universe and wondered if there is some kind of order behind all that is. So there is a notion that even though you look out into the world and it looks extremely confusing, that really there is some sort of secret, or what I like to call the hidden code of nature, that can explain all there is. And the first exponent of that was the philosopher Pythagoras, that we all know from his Pythagorean theorem of the triangles that we learned in high school. Well, Pythagoras believed that the world was the creation of some sort of cosmic mind, and that he respected some very precise geometric laws. And so the role of the philosopher for his sect, he had some kind of sect in ancient Greece, the role of the philosopher was to unveil these geometric laws and hence read the mind of God. And this sort of notion survived and morphed, but survived for centuries, for millennia, really, got into the Renaissance, and our patriarchs of modern science like Galileo and Kepler and Newton, they were all trying to live up to the Pythagorean dream, which is essentially to unveil this hidden code, which they all believed was a mathematical code. And then we get to modern times, and the same idea is here. Of course, for Newton and for Kepler, the so-called hidden code of nature really was something created by God. So they were after the literal mind of God. But then the literal became the metaphorical with the work of modern physics. And so when you get into the last 30, 40 years, the reading of the mind of God, as Stephen Hawking actually wrote in his book, Brief History of Time, is essentially finding the theory of everything, or the final theory.
And you point to the most popular current candidate as the super string theory, which says...
Exactly. So the most popular candidate is the superstring theory, which essentially is what you said in the intro, is an attempt to unify or to write a theory that brings together Einstein's theory of relativity that describes big things like galaxies, big heavy stars and the universe, and little things, which is the theory of quantum mechanics that describes atoms and the nucleus of atoms and the particles that live inside these nuclei into one big scheme. And that's perfectly fine. You know, we do want to understand how these two big theories of the 20th century merge. Well, the problem is trying to find this unified theory of everything.
Mm-hmm. You say that scientists who believe in this unified code, you call them unifiers in the book, aren't that much different than people who believe in one Jewish or Christian or Muslim God, one creator of the universe. Explain that.
Yes. Right. And this is a notion that I'm sure is going to horrify some physicists because
right.
they probably don't even know that they are monotheistic in their thinking. And they are. Essentially, the idea is that when you're trying to find a unique explanation for all there is, and this unique explanation essentially brings together thousands of years of cultural baggage. And it is no surprise that it's so strong in the Western world, you know, this notion that there is sort of this unique explanation. Because from a religious perspective, if God created everything, everything came from God, and hence everything is ultimately unified in God's existence. And so instead of thinking of God, you know, science that became more atheistic in the last 400 years, thinks of the mathematics of nature, the mathematics of creation, and hence this metaphor of the mind of God. But yes, the notion, this unifying notion, is essentially a monotheistic notion.
Mm-hmm. So you put these people into two categories, thinking the unifiers and the believers. You are suggesting there is a third alternative. What is that?
Well, people like me, that we are not unifiers, and I have to stress that I spent about 15 years of my career working as a unifier. I did my PhD in superstring theory. I wrote about 40 papers on this topic, so it's not like I'm an outsider here.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, this this notion, this change that happened to me, it wasn't an easy change. It was a personal struggle in many ways, because I kept working on this, and I looked at my colleagues, and I started to think, wait a second, what is the evidence that we have for all of this? You know, what is the experiments, what are they telling us? The experiments, the astronomical observations, are they giving us any hint that these search for a unification is really on track, or are we just being completely delusional in a sense? And so I looked at the last 50 years of what we have learned in particle physics and in cosmology, as I explain in my book, and there really is not a single inkling that indeed there is such a thing as a unified theory of nature.
Mm.
There are partial unifications, but no such thing as a final unification.
Don't we, our acceptance of what we mentioned, what you mentioned in the book, Einstein's theory of relativity or quantum mechanics, aren't they partial parts of the puzzle of this unified theory of everything?
Well, not necessarily. They are basically just descriptions of nature. So there's nothing in there that points to a unification at all. You see, what we have learned is the following, is that symmetry, the notion of symmetry, of mathematical symmetry, is extremely important in describing the natural world. And there's no question about that. I'll be a fool to say that symmetry is not important. And so there is an attempt to construct theories that are highly symmetrical. And we do that. But then we go and we make our measurements, and a lot of those symmetries, not all of them, but many of these symmetries are not perfect. They are approximations. And the more we learn about nature, the more we understand that it's precisely because these symmetries are not perfect, that there are small asymmetries, that interesting things happen in the world. For example, the existence of matter, the existence of life, as I explain in the book, they are both results of these small asymmetries. So the task at hand to me is not so much to understand this sort of holy grail unification of everything, but really what is the origin of these asymmetries and why are they here?
Mm-hmm.
And so the third group of people, you know, between the unifiers and the believers, are the people that are still fascinated with the mysteries of nature, but they are not, one, looking for a final explanation of everything, or two, believe in supernatural causes.
Now, one of the examples that you just mentioned that you bring out is in the book in detail, is the origin of the universe. We used to believe in, I believe it's called the stable universe, and now the most popular theory is the Big Bang or the burst, right? And so you're saying the asymmetry in that thinking is, yes, but what came before the Big Bang, or what caused the Big Bang, or what caused life after the Big Bang?
Right. So many things there. That's right. There used to be a competition between these two theories. It's you're almost there. It's called the steady state theory.
Steady state, yep.
And the Big Bang. The steady state basically said the universe doesn't really change in time or in space. You know, if you look out, it's kind of the same everywhere. And the Big Bang says, well, in space, that's true, but in time, that's not true. The universe did have a beginning about 14 billion years ago. And the notion that the universe has a history, that it has an era of time, that it changes as it goes by, is very, very important, because it brings this asymmetry into the game. You see, in the steady state model, because there was no change in the big scheme of things, the universe was always the same, and there was no asymmetry in time. But the Big Bang says, no, the universe had a beginning just like we do, and so it had sort of like a birthday. And it's been expanding and changing ever since. And the notion that the universe has a history is extremely important to us. It sort of brings the universe closer to us, if you want. And it also kind of answers a little bit this question you said about what happened before the Big Bang, because to us, the notion of a before the Big Bang doesn't really make sense because there was no time. See, time starts to tick when things start to change. And if things do not change, there's nothing for time to measure. So in a perfect universe, in a sense, there would be no global time. And we need an imperfect universe because we know time is around. We see it happening to us all the time.
Okay, we have about 10 minutes left. I want to have us attempt to wrap our minds around what you're saying a little bit more. What are the implications of this new thinking that you're proposing, that this asymmetrical take on science?
Well, you know, it has two very important implications. The first one that is basically I'm proposing a new aesthetic for science. I'm proposing a new way of thinking about the world where the emphasis is in a science that is not perfect, that is not out to explain everything, but a science that is human, you know, that is a construction, a narrative that we build to understand the world as best as we can. And we do wonderful things with that, but we know that it's never going to have all the final answers. There is one very reason for that, a very simple reason for that, which is all that we understand about the world depends on our instruments, our tools. You know, we measure things so that we can talk about them. And our measuring tools, even though they are wonderful and always improving, they're never going to be able to measure all there is to measure, which means we'll never be able to know all there is to know. And so if we can't know all there is to know, there is no way in which we'll have a final theory, simply because tomorrow somebody may discover a new tool that will reveal something unexpected that doesn't fit into that theory. So the very notion of a finality of knowledge is just a nonsense thing. And that's one of the things that I'm trying to demolish.
What happens then to spirituality, for instance, when Wonderful. We don't have oneness either in a religious sense or in a scientific sense?
Well, then that's where the wonderful part comes in, which is sort of the second part of the book, which is when I start to talk about life and what this means to life. Because as I explained there, life is always also the product of asymmetries. It's also something that happened because all sorts of asymmetric factors came into the game, both at the sort of biochemical level. You know, if you look at the molecules of life, you find that they have asymmetries, which are very, very important. DNA would not reproduce if it weren't asymmetric in many ways. And so we have that. And then we start to think about the history of life here on Earth. What happened in the last 3.5 billion years since life first appeared? And realize that life, the history of life, is also the product of all these random accidents. And that says, a lot of people say, but wait a second, you know, if life is the product of random accidents, if everything is a random accident, so what's the meaning of all? You know, what's the point, right? Are we just a random accident, and that's just horrible? You know, we don't want that. And they go into this existentialist crisis. And I'm saying, no, wait a second. You're getting this wrong. The whole point is that because we are the product of accidents, we are extremely special. Because if you look at the solar system, you look at the other planets around us, and you see they are wonderful, beautiful worlds, but they are all barren. There is no life there. If there is any kind of life in Mars and one of the moons out there, it's going to be very simple, primitive life. There is nothing even close to Earth. And the same is going to be true for most of the planets around other stars in our cosmic neighborhood, which means the following. It means, first of all, the Earth is an oasis, is a very, very special place. And second, the fact that Earth was able to develop intelligent life, meaning us, we all hope we are intelligent, you know, we'll see if we are or not. I mean, it looks like we are okay, but I'm not quite sure sometimes, right? Like, I'm sure most of your listeners agree with that. But still, the fact that we are intelligent makes us extremely special again. So even though science has thought us that, you know, humans are not the center of the universe. What I'm proposing is a different way of thinking about it, in which we are the center of things. It's what I call a human centrism, in which human beings become the cosmic consciousness. We are the way the universe thinks about itself, and that makes us super special.
Mm-hmm.
And hence, go ahead, sorry.
No, but also in terms of intelligent life elsewhere in the cosmos, is this what you mean when you write in the book that if intelligent life exists outside of Earth, it would be, quote, inexistent? Inexistent. What does that mean?
I think what I mean there is essentially that even if life exists out there, it's going to most probably be simple, meaning, you know, unicellular, amoeba-like stuff. It's not going to be multicellular. But we cannot know that for sure. So quite possibly there will be some planet very similar to Earth, I don't know, 100, 200 light years away from us or 2,000 light years away from us, where we could have some sort of intelligent life. But the point is that they are so far away from us, so remote, that for all practical purposes, we are alone. And we have to come to grips with this cosmic loneliness of ours and realize that because we are alone, we have no answers coming to us from elsewhere, from gods, from intelligent aliens. We have to come up with these answers ourselves. And we have some very pressing issues right now in our planet, and the decisions that we make now are going to define the future of the Earth and of the future generations for a few decades. So the book ends as kind of like a manifesto for humanity to unite around its humanity and around the sacredness of life, which is, I support, a very spiritual undertaking.
What has been the reaction to your arguments by fellow scientists? Are you viewed as a heretic of sorts?
Well, you know, so far I've been amazingly surprised by how receptive they are. Although tomorrow I'm going to give a talk at MIT, and we'll see what happens there. But so far it's been quite good because a lot of the scientists are fed up with this notion of unification. You know, I think I'm just being the voice of many, you know, but this notion has been growing of discontent, if you want, amongst the scientific community. And because it's been 40 years and all the predictions that were made were not vindicated, and there's no real supporting evidence for this. So somebody has to say it, and I guess I'm the one who is saying it and also proposing that this is not the end of spirituality. It's actually quite the opposite. It's the beginning of a new kind of spirituality.
In recent years, we've heard a lot about the war between science and religion from such people as, well, Richard Dawkins. He was on this program. Also, Christopher Hitchens, who say that he says that religious belief is a dangerous form of delusion. How do they fit into this picture for you?
Well, I am very much against the extreme Dawkins, Hitchens, Sam Harris and company position. I think that to deem faith as a delirious attitude is just completely insensitive and unreasonable, considering that about 90% of the human population has some kind of belief. So if they want to say that science is the antidote to religion, I think they're just wrong. I think what science has to offer is a way of thinking about the world in which the human identity can be related in a spiritual way with creation without a supernatural belief. So in response to these positions, I always say that I think that there are two different kinds of people, the naturalists and the supernaturalists. And to me, the supernaturalists are going to be the people that are going to say that there exists some sort of unknowable influence in the world, and this unknowable influence in the world is what makes things go around, so to speak. And the naturalists are going to say, no, there is no such thing as an unknowable influence. There are just things that we don't know yet. And hence, the goal of science is to know as much as possible about nature, knowing that it will never know everything.
You are convinced of this. We will never know everything. Science, no matter if we go 1,000, 2,000, how many thousand years, we'll never know anything, everything.
Absolutely. I am 100% convinced of that simply because we can't. You know, we can't because to know things, we have to measure things, and we'll never be able to measure all there is to measure.
We have
humans. have to embrace ignorance and be happy with that and understand that we live surrounded by this kind of darkness, you know, which is not a supernatural darkness populated by spirits and fairies and stuff. It's just what we don't know about nature.
Very quickly, you write that humanity is at a crossroads. What is the crossroads that we're at, and why would it make a difference to believe in a symmetry or an asymmetry in the universe?
Well, the crossroads that I'm referring about is related to climate change and nuclear disarmament, which are very much in the day right now, right? I mean, here we are talking about the day in which the nuclear treaty talks are starting in D.C. So I'm talking about that, you know, that we are globally a species that can obliterate ourselves either very quickly through nuclear engagement or slowly through climate deterioration due to global warming, etc. And it's time for us to understand that at a very deep level. And it's the notion of symmetry and asymmetry. In a sense, what I'm saying by that is that we have to understand that nature is imperfect and that our world is imperfect and that we are imperfect. However, we having the power to understand and think about nature, we are at a position where we can save things, we can change things. And that's my call for arms, essentially, for us to wake up and understand that we are it. And because we are it, we have a big, big mission ahead of us.
Marcelo Gleiser, thank you for spending the time with us, joining us from New Hampshire. A Tear at the Edge of Creation, his new book, A Radical New Vision for Life in an Imperfect Universe. Thank you very much, Professor Gleiser.
It was my pleasure. This was very nice. Thank you.
The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.